Gonna sing a song of freedom, sing Sweet Honey in the Rock, and James Horner. We here at Solution to Balance and our guest today, Dr. Kate Fossil, believe freedom for all is a good idea. But for us, freedom has to do with fairness, equity, and solving conflict without violence. Hello, folks. We are Solution to Balance. We are happy you could join us here today on WFMP Radio. You're listening to Forward Radio, WFMP 106.5 FM. Solution to Balance is a program of and sponsored by Forward Radio. I'm your host, Jump Johnson. Following as part of WFMP's public affairs educational programming, the views expressed are those of our guests and not necessarily that of the station. If you'd like to share your views, you can contact us at solutionsofbalance18@gmail.com. We'd love to hear from you. Our guest today is Dr. Kate Fossil, Professor Emeritus, former Director of the University of Louisville's Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, and founder and former Director of the University of Louisville's Anne Braden Institute. Today's Kate Fossil presentation was recorded at Hotel Louisville as part of the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation and Swords of Justice's Third Thursday Lunch Series, occurred March 21st, 2024. We'd like to thank the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation and Swords of Justice for their sponsorship of the Third Thursday Lunch event. Beverly Marmion will welcome the Third Thursday Lunch live audience and introduce Dr. Kate Fossil.
Dr. Catherine Fossil has a distinguished academic career with publications and the other things that entitle her to her tenure at the University of Louisville as a member of the Department of Women and Gender Studies. I want to talk about Kate in regard to her relationship with Anne Braden and with Louisville because there are so many parallels there. Both Anne and Kate had white Southern childhoods, and both have deep Kentucky roots. Anne was born in 1924 at St. Anthony's Hospital and lived for a few years in the Highlands with her parents. But her father had a job which required him to travel about, and so he moved to West Virginia, back to Kentucky, eventually down to Alabama as Anne was growing up, before she moved to Louisville as a journalist to join the Louisville Times. 20 or so years later, she already had a familiarity with Louisville and its white culture. Kate grew up in Georgia, but spent her summers here, at least during her childhood and early teenage years, with her great-grandmother, who lived in Portland. So Kate, as well, before her career began, knew Louisville. Kate grew up as Jim Crow was trying to come to an end and as school desegregation was passing across the South. She was interested in what was going on around her and began to question some of her parents and other friends' attitudes about the racial situation here. She was interested in journalism and spent the 1990s and much of the 80s working in journalism and community affairs. And she became interested in Anne Braden and wanted eventually to write Anne's biography. She met Anne unexpectedly in Atlanta and began to talk to her in person about doing this, and Anne was reluctant to agree to that, but it took some persuasion on Kate's part, but Anne finally agreed that Kate could begin to interview her for her book about Anne Braden and the right backlash in the social justice issues of the 60s and onwards. So in any case, Kate received her PhD degree from Emory University in 2000, and shortly after, she joined the faculty at U of L in the Department of Women's and Gender Studies. Her book, Anne Braden, Subversive Southerner, published, I think, in 2002. Kate became first director of the Anne Braden Institute for Social Justice Research in 2006. That was the year that Anne died. In any case, I feel like Anne is still here. So many of us knew her, worked with her, were friends, as well as with Kate. So Kate is going to give us our program about Anne's spiritual granddaughters and the legacy Anne has left behind through the Anne Braden Institute. So Kate, it's all yours.
Well, thank you so much, Beverly, for that very generous introduction. We thought, well, two things. Thanks to all of you for coming out today, and thanks to the FOR for having me for this event. When Beverly invited me, we talked about a program on Anne Braden. You know, we agreed, though, that most of the people that come to these luncheons either knew Anne Braden or know Anne Braden's story. So we came up, or I came up with this idea to talk more about about the mentorship and the generations sort of bouncing off of Anne Braid and her legacy. And the other thing I just wanted to say is, I have a special thanks for Beverly, because I've been a real pain to Beverly, could I say? I know I have been a terrible pain just by wanting to show this slideshow. And so thank you, Beverly, and all of you for that forbearance. I do want to say a little bit, it was really an honor the way that she sort of put me in the trajectory of Anne Braden, who would have been 100 years old this year. So that's an important anniversary to mark. But let me just say that not only was Anne, for those of you who knew Anne, because I know there's plenty in this room, Anne was a very cantankerous woman. It took a kind of stubbornness to go through what she went through and to give your life really over to social and racial justice the way she did. And she was stubborn, okay? And so when I first asked her to let me write this book, I mean, there are just a couple things I want to say. Like, Beverly, it wasn't a chance meeting with Anne in Atlanta. It was me having persuaded Anne and talked to her about the idea of a book. And originally, it was going to be a book that we were going to write together, because, you know, Anne was a very, very skilled, eloquent writer herself. And as many of you know her story, she had been horribly misrepresented in the press for decades by the time she met me in the late 80s. So she wasn't very keen on having somebody write about her. So I had to really earn Anne Braden's trust. And finally, it became my book, because she just realized it was going to be like an autobiography as told to me. And finally, she just said, go on and write the damn thing, because I just don't have time. You know, I'm too busy to write. And so you just go on and do it. Now, that said, I would not call this an authorized biography. However, I mean, she was like over my shoulder quite a bit with it. So what Beverly also perhaps did not know was that the first portion of this book was my dissertation. So I'm one of those rare birds that actually went to get a PhD in history because I needed to learn the history surrounding Anne Braden's story. So I didn't actually go to become a professor. That was my career trajectory, but it wasn't my reason for going. It was when I first started reading all this history that I realized, like, I don't know enough history. My bachelor's degree, as you heard, was in journalism. I really didn't know much history. So I thought history was horribly boring. It was just like wars and presidents and diplomats. And then all of a sudden, like, I learned, oh, the 1950s, which is the decade I was born in, and the 1960s, which was a very exciting time to grow up during. Oh, that's history too, right? So I'm that historian that a lot of, if we had a room full of historians, they'd say, like, she's not a real historian because it's not, you know, 100 years ago, but I will dispute that. So with that said, I want to just talk to you about Anne's legacy. And this picture here, for those of you who haven't seen it, that's a pretty widely used picture, was taken in about 1961. So Anne would have been not yet 40 in that picture, somewhere in her mid-30s. She always identified as a journalist, even though she left mainstream journalism at a very young age from the Louisville Times here in Louisville, and gave her life over to movement journalism, activist journalism, which, you know, many journalists value objectivity, and Anne threw that right out the window. And she said, we all have a position anyway, and my position is for justice. So she and Carl worked throughout the late 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s, and he died in the 70s. And then she worked those remaining decades for the rest of her life using those writing skills in service of social and racial justice. So she's seen here, that's her living room out there on Virginia Avenue, 44th and Virginia, interviewing Rosa Parks just a few years after Rosa Parks became famous in the Montgomery bus boycott. So that's around, we're not sure if it's 60 or 61, but I'm mentioning this because it's important to, like, Anne knew a lot of, like, luminary civil rights leaders. And the way that she knew them was that there were so few people, really, but especially white people, who were working for civil rights in that era. And so it wasn't a huge, you know, we think think about all of you are involved in social movements, and sometimes we feel beleaguered. It feels small, and it felt small to them, even in 1960, 1961. So she came to know people like Rosa Parks, like Dr. King, and Coretta used to stay right there in the Braden's home when they first came to Louisville, because he wasn't famous. He was not famous prior to the Nobel Peace Prize. So that's kind of the starting point. And who in here doesn't know Anne's story? Is there anybody? Okay, well, I don't want to tell that story because I'm here to talk about legacy. But I can't leave this early photo of Anne without just mentioning the Wade sedition case that made them sort of famous, or you might say notorious, here in Louisville. That label of Reds followed them all across the South, and especially here in Louisville, all through the 50s, 60s, and 70s. So in 1954, they had really trespassed the color line by acting as the fronts to assist a black couple, Andrew and Charlotte Wade, to buy a home in what is today Shively, because they couldn't buy it on their own because, not because of law, there were no laws against it, but because of custom. And then when they did move in, again, I'm sure this is a review for all of you, but it's such a powerful, really foundational piece of the people they became, that the Wades, you know, there were crosses burned, there were epithets thrown at them, and that house was dynamited 6 weeks after they moved into it. And because of what we think of the charge of terrorism, but in the 1950s, it was communism. And the whole thing was thought to be a communist plot to bring down, to cede land from whites to blacks, part of a campaign that would then bring down the government of Kentucky and the United States and usher in a United Socialist Republic. Okay, so that all sounds very, well, doesn't sound that bad to me now, but whatever. It sounds very extreme, I think, by our lights, that kind of one simple act like that could represent that whole huge plot. But Carl, as you know, was convicted, held on the highest bond ever set in the state of Kentucky at that time, and sentenced to 15 years, served 8 months in solitary confinement at the LaGrange Reformatory. And they were the parents of two young children. Their children had to be sent to live in Alabama with her parents. It was a tough time for them. But if you've heard her speak about this, then you would know that what she would say, what looks like the worst thing that ever happened to you, turns out to have maybe been the best thing that ever happened to you, because it burned her bridges to a privileged past. Okay. So when I met Anne Braden, and I didn't exactly meet her, I heard her speak at a rally of thousands of people, the first major rally I had ever been to, in 1980, after the Communist Workers' Party anti-Klan activists were murdered by the Klan, brutally shot down in Greensboro, North Carolina in 1979, and got very involved in that campaign. And back then, I wasn't involved in racial justice campaigns. I was kind of a peace activist, right? And I got recruited to go to that demonstration by people that were more involved in both. But I just didn't really realize there were a lot of white people speaking out for racial justice. And it was such a huge crowd of thousands, I didn't ever see Anne Braden that day. You couldn't see. They were piping it up, way up, so far from the stage. But when I heard that voice, I'd never met her, never heard of her, but when I heard that voice, I was like, that is a white Southern woman saying those words. And that stayed with me in the most profound way. So then when I started really reading any kind of social justice history of the 60s, I would run across Anne Braden in the footnotes. And I finally got hold of her memoir, The Wall Between, and it was out of print. I read it in an archive, and I was like, wow. I mean, it was just a year after that, I was born and started coming to Louisville as a child, and a bunch of my relatives lived out in there in Shively near where the Wade home had been, but that history was completely buried. I started asking some of them about Anne Braden, because they were like, a couple of them are still alive in their 80s today, and they're like, oh my gosh, those radicals. Yes, that was a terrible, because that's the kind of background I come from, too. Okay, so setting the stage, right? The other thing I want to say about Anne Braden before we go to talk about her her legacy is about her persistence, okay? Some of you know this picture. If you go to the Braden Center out on West Broadway, you see it hanging there. She was arrested for protesting the all-white vendorship at the Valhalla Golf Tournament in 1996 with a group of folks led by Reverend Lewis Coleman, who you probably know was our central Black civil rights leader in the early part of this century and the last part of the last. But my point being is that a lot of people have a period in their 20s and 30s when they're activists. Not everybody stays with it. And we've got a lot of folks in this room who have stayed with it. And I appreciate that. So I just wanted to talk about it because I think that persistence matters, certainly when it comes to the legacy that I also want to talk about. And so I don't want to leave that issue of persistence without calling the name of George and Jean Edwards in this room, because George and Jean Edwards were very close to Anne. George and Jean Edwards, that's why we have a Louisville FOR, George and Jean Edwards. And they stayed with it. And as I was looking for pictures today, even as recently as like, we were looking at pictures last night. I looked at dozens, scores of pictures to come up with some of these. And we saw a picture of them dancing at Carla Wallace's lawn party in the early 2000s. That is George and Jean for you. Okay, so let's take a moment to remember them. Now, before I get to the granddaughters, okay, let's talk about some of the daughters. There's sons too, and we've got some right here in this room, but we're going to stick to daughters today, okay, since it's Women's History Month. So I want to say this is not an exhaustive group at all. Anne has many, many, many spiritual sons and daughters in this town and across the nation, but I just want to recognize a few. And especially from left to right, I'll just say Betty Payne, Carla Wallace, Maddie Jones, Pam McMichael, Diane Moten. Maddie Jones, I have enormous respect for. She's not quite young enough to be Anne's daughter, okay? But she was Anne's peer and Anne's very, very, very close friend, okay? So she's in the picture. And all of these other women were very inspired by Anne Braden. And I especially want to call out, shout out to the spiritual daughtership, we'll call it, I'm just making up words, of Carla Wallace and Pam McMichael, because Carla grew up knowing Anne Braden because her parents were friends with the Bradens, okay? So Carla Wallace came from a left-wing family. She was what they call a red diaper baby. So she came into this work knowing Anne. And when she finished college and came back to Louisville looking for how to get involved, she knew to go to Anne Braden first thing. And so Anne, as you might imagine, recruited Carla into the Kentucky Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. And Carla was very involved. And so that's how Carla got to know Maddie, and that's how she got to know Betty. Carla also was in the process. Carla was a strong feminist of the sort of second wave variation, but an early example of what you'd call an intersectional feminist. We can talk more about that if you like, but worked on other issues than a narrow understanding of gender justice, okay? But she was also coming into her own life as lesbian. So she became friends and sweethearts with Pam McMichael. She recruited Pam, who's more like, her background's a little bit more like mine's and Anne's in the sense of like white, rural, conservative, okay? And it was a real eye-opener for Pam, who was a very involved lesbian feminist at the time. This all started in the early 80s is the time I'm talking about. But once Carla recruited Pam into the Kentucky Alliance, then they began to notice there were gay and lesbian issues. Discrimination was flowering, was becoming more and more visible, and there was a gay rights movement nationally, and they wanted to start an organization here in Louisville that was different than the gay rights movement nationally, that really put racial justice at its center. And I would credit Anne and Maddie and people like them were the genesis of those ideas. Okay, so we have had a very, very powerful movement for Fairness that talks about worker justice, environmental justice, reproductive justice, and yes, always racial justice. And so that is part of Ann Braden's legacy. Carla tells a great story about how when she approached Ann and told her that she wants to start a gay and lesbian anti-discrimination group, and she did talk to her about the racial justice at the center of it, Ann's like, oh no, that's terrible. You're going to be leaving the Alliance. You're going to leave racism out of it. That's just how people do. You know, Carla just persisted. And they didn't leave racism out of it. And some years later, Ann came to Carla and Pam and she apologized. And she said, thank God we have a fairness campaign. Okay. So Ann grew through that in her own understanding of movements for sexuality and gender identity freedoms. Okay. So I just wanted to say there's many more spiritual daughters I could mention, but I just especially wanted to call attention to those few. And Diane Moten became, who's on the end near me, became really the first Black lesbian who was outspoken in the early fairness campaign. So all of these folks became very, very dear friends and friends in the movement. So now I'm going to shift a little bit and talk about the Ann Braden Institute. And I know whoever wrote the description of this talk says, Kate Fossil considers herself one of Ann Braden's spiritual daughters. I might not have put that out there quite like that, but yes, I'm honored to say that I too was mentored and changed by Ann Braden to the point where I worked with our then dean, and you'll see him later in this slideshow, Dr. J. Blaine Hudson, to propose. Ann had just died, and it was quite a blow. It was a big blow to all of us because Ann was only 25 years ago. I might have said, oh, Ann was 81. People die at 81. As I'm pushing 70 myself, I'm like, 81, she was young, you know, but she could have lived 10 years longer, I think, had she not worked herself to death. She was that dedicated. But at any rate, the city, as many of you know, was really in a tailspin over her death, and certainly the Kentucky Alliance was. And I, meanwhile, was in this, you know, U of L didn't initially hire me as a professor. I was hired for this thing they call postdoc scholar. I'm in my 40s, so it wasn't that easy to be an older postdoc scholar. And you do the same as a professor, but you get 2/3 of the salary, right? And you don't have any job security. So I went on the job market and was offered a job at the University of Memphis, which has the Benjamin Hooks Institute for Social Change. And it had the Center for Research on Women, and they were very closely aligned. And it was the center. So I was offered the directorship of the Center for Research on Women at University of Memphis. Well, my family was here. My children were in school here. I loved Louisville. Ann had recruited me in a big way to get active in the Kentucky Alliance, to get active against racism on the campus and in the community. So I was pretty rooted here by 2006, and I didn't want to leave. So Ann, it was a trauma for many of us when Ann died, but I came back to the university, and I talked to my dean, my boss, Blaine Hudson, and I said, I don't want to leave. Let's do this here. And we sat down together and hammered out what we meant by let's do this here. There might have been a social and racial justice research institute anyway, but it followed so closely on the heels of her death that it made sense to name it for her. And with his help, we were able to bring in the Braden's entire books collection. We have a huge collection of manuscripts and documents out of their home. All of their work that dealt specifically with Louisville is at the University of Louisville today. Thank you to Blaine Hudson. Okay. So we set about doing this, and this shows our grand opening. And our first speaker was Julian Bond. There's the poster. There's the ribbon. He cut the ribbon that day, and we had the grand opening of our reading room, which many of you have been to on the in the Ekstrom Library on the campus. Okay. He's no longer with us, and that was a horrible blow as well, because he seemed a fairly young man at the time, and that was in 2007, coming up on the 17th anniversary of that, and then he left this world in 2014. It was a glorious occasion, okay? It was a glorious occasion, I think, for the campus. and for the city. And the mission of the Ann Braden Institute was and remains to bridge the gap between campus and community on issues of social and racial justice. Okay, so we, and I say we because I am still involved, even though I'm now a volunteer pretty much, are still working on that mission today. But this was our glorious start. And I do want to point out here are two of, this is a preview of the spiritual granddaughters that are coming up. You see Shamika Parrish Wright, who we're going to hear more about. I'm sure all of you are very well aware of her commitment. And then there's me with, once I didn't have this gray hair. And I just want to take you through a few of the things that we did. Blaine and I co-founded that institute in 2006-07. It was approved by the trustees in 2006 at the end of the year. It opened officially, as you saw, in April 2007. And I directed it for 15 years. I stepped down in the summer of 2021. So in those 15 years, we did a lot. And that would take the rest of this talk to talk to you about it. But I'm not going to do that. I just want to hit a few highlights. So there you see Dean Hudson, who was not just a dean. I mean, I've had like four more deans since he died his untimely death in 2012. But he was a dean who was very, very involved in the initiatives that he cared about. And one of the things he cared so much about was Louisville. And, you know, just a little sidebar, because he would be classified as a spiritual son of Ann Braden, that he met the Bradens. He knew them growing up because he grew up in West Louisville where they lived. But he didn't know them that well until, as a student activist at U of L in the late 60s, he was head of the Black Student Union. And the Bradens had the SCEF office. Well, Doug McGee knows that office. Many of you do. It's the Alliance headquarters and the Braden Center today. But at that time, there were two houses that were the SCEF offices, and they had a mimeograph machine that they let other community groups use. So the Black Student Union, they came to know the Bradens really well because they went over there to generate and print all their materials, okay? So that was his real hands-on introduction to Ann Braden, and they remained friends the rest of her life. But there he is. That was in 2010 when we celebrated the 50th anniversary of the sit-ins that had swept the South nonviolently, that really did break down legal segregation of public accommodations. And so we had a reenactment of a sit-in in February of 2010, and he came and talked about the larger history that had happened and he had been part of here in Louisville. We had twice visits from the Reverend Vincent Harding, who was a very revered civil rights leader who you might have read or heard of, who was also a very close personal friend of Ann's. Okay, so they had been friends going way back. And he's probably most famous, not for his own writings, but as a speech writer who wrote the majority of Dr. King's very famous anti-war speech, Beyond Vietnam, that was in, he delivered at Riverside Church in 1967. And Vincent Harding, I mean, this man is the closest thing to a saint I've ever known. I was very privileged, and that's the issue of legacy. I would never have come to know Vincent Harding the way I did had I not been walking Ann's footsteps and working in that tradition named after her, because he sought me out then. And I was able to get him to come speak to classes at U of L. He was an amazing, amazingly brilliant orator and speaker, and just really the kindest person, top 10 I've ever known. So just a few more highlights. We developed a civil rights history tour. If I hadn't been so busy with the technology, I would have brought some in and put them out. I know Akram Burton, who's a partner on that tour, had them out last month at this talk. So maybe you all have them. It's an updated tour. We premiered it in 2010, and that's at the Louisville Airport. They asked us to create that exhibit for it. So it got a lot of, I think it did help get wider exposure to Black history in this city at the time. And which is, there are many other avenues for now, but there were not so many in 2010. This was an exhibit that we did, I think, in 2012 for Day of the Dead, which is a Latinx celebratory holiday. And they asked us for the at the Kentucky Museum of Art and Craft to put together an exhibit in which Anne was one of the dead who was honored. So you see some of her writings, and those are some, you know, we have a lot of her memorabilia there at the Braden Institute. Is that this picture here? There's an irony in this. If you think about what happened here in 2020. In 2010 to 2012, the ABI got a pretty major grant working here with the Center for Health Equity on what we call a racial healing project. And the Ann Braden Institute's portion of it, because it is a problem, and I'm sure this would be a problem that you all have encountered before as well. When you're getting a massive grant and you've had such racial disparity, you want the masses of the money to go to, you know, BIPOC communities that have been denied access, right? And so it was a small part of a much larger grant. But I, thinking about Ann Braden's legacy, said we have got to involve some white people in this and teach some white Louisvillians from the East End too Black history, Louisville's Black history. So what we did at the ABI was operate, we had a cohort of 20 students, community people from all over the city that applied and got admitted, and they agreed to go through this 6-month study group. We don't have any alums here, I don't think, today. I mean, they often turn up. I was at a press conference. Dre Dawson, who's Shamika Parrish's legislative assistant, who was also very, very much of a leader in the Breonna Taylor uprisings of 2020. He was in the Healing History Academy. We had ranging ages. It was multiracial, multi-zip code, and multi-age from, like, I think the youngest was 20 and the oldest was like 75. So it was a cross-section of Louisvillians who agreed to a 6-month process where they would read and study the homework that we gave them, and they would come together monthly for a discussion or a program. And we the African American Theater program at U of L performed for them. We had speakers. We had book groups. We had many, many different kinds of things, culminating with the Michelle Alexander lecture on the new Jim Crow that following year. And at the end of the Healing History Academy, Mayor Greg Fisher gave all of us a Healing History Ambassador pin. Okay, so there we are with Greg Fisher getting those pins in 2012. And I want to just show you a preview here. But this is Amber Duke, who was your speaker month before last, who is also going to appear in a moment again, and who was the was first a student volunteer with the Ann Braden Institute and became our program coordinator for almost 3 years. So she was kind of the convener of that group. I was more like I was the director and she was the producer. Let's call it like that. And then this is from 2014, when we had partnered with the Louisville Free Public Library to have the 60-year commemoration of the Wade case that I told you about. In summary, we had an exhibit all through that main hall of the library. But this was a powerful moment. Bob Cunningham, who many of you know, was our MC that night. But these three young Black folks are Andrew Wade's granddaughters and great nephew. And the Wades had never come out to anything that we had done. And they came and they spoke, and I've been in touch with two of those three ever since. So it was, for me personally, having written that history, it was very, very meaningful. And I know it would have meant an awful lot to Ann Braden, now to the granddaughters. And these folks I'm listing, I want to say a couple more things. This is not an exhaustive list. I was not able to reach every student that we worked with. I no longer have contact with them, so this is a select group. But it's not Carla's and Pam's in my generation. It's the next generation and then the next generation. So they are the granddaughters, okay? And so the first one I want to mention is Shamika Parrish Wright, who came to work with Anne as an intern when she first came here from Cincinnati, and she was at at the Jefferson Community College. She came, and that's how she met Ann Braden, and that's how she got involved with the Kentucky Alliance, which she's, you know, co-chaired many times and been a huge leader of many, many, many issues here in Louisville since then. And so I wrote to a group of these folks when Beverly and I talked about the topic. I just wrote to them and said, you know, could you tell me what you're doing now, which I did know that about Shamika, but not all of them. Could you tell me what was the impact of Ann Braden on you? And are there any lessons you want to comment on that you got from being a student or staffer at the Ann Braden Institute, the ABI? And so this is what they said. So Shamika is today, for those of you who don't know it, the District 3 Louisville Metro Councilwoman. She's spearheaded fightbacks against all the bad stuff that is coming our way. And she's promoted all the good stuff that is not getting enough airtime in this state today. Here's what she said. That she wrote this to me just yesterday. Ann's intentionality with her legacy informed me the most. She was a connector who worked to motivate people to take action. Our lives haven't been the same since Ann Braden. Many of us have stayed engaged with the social justice movement, both locally and abroad. Ann saw the world through the eyes of an organizer. She was not perfect, but focused. Her gift to the world was bringing us together, no matter what walk of life, in the ongoing fight to end racism and racist practices in every form. And Shamika and I got to know each other really initially through Ann's death, through planning Ann's memorial. I knew Shamika very slightly, but we came together about that, and we've been working together periodically ever since. And she was part of the strategic planning process that set the mission of the ABI back in 2008, and she has remained as a community advisory council member ever since, and still is doing that today. So she said, the ABI has influenced my journey as a forever student who believes that communities should have full access to the data and reports they're a part of. So Shamika was, I would have to say, kind of almost like the original, Ann Braden, the spiritual granddaughter that I got to work with. The next one was the young woman that I showed you in the picture at the grand opening with Julian Bond, Yardana Peacock, who, you know, doing this work as a white person, especially at U of L, where there's a very vibrant Pan-African Studies department, there is very vibrant Black leadership. But a lot of times, it's still very like, you're over there and I'm over here type of thing. And so I really wanted to always maintain a multiracial staff, okay? So the Department of Pan-African Studies, this was Blaine Hudson's idea, they assigned us a graduate assistant. And I'll never forget it, because that first year when we were not even open yet, and the vast majority of their students are Black. And so I was waiting to hear who the student would be. And Teresa Rajak-Talley, who was associate chair over there, but really a great supporter of the ABI, she called me on the phone. She said, Kate, I've got a great student for you. I've got the perfect student for you. And I'm like, okay, like, what do you mean? And she said, well, she comes from Northern Kentucky, where Ann taught the last 5 years of her life. But Yardana was Ann's student at NKU. And she said, oh, she's very committed to racial justice. She's this, she's that. And she said, but I want to warn you, she's white. And I was like, well, darn, you know, like, that's not so great. We don't want to be all white. But I got to tell you, Teresa was brilliant, and she was right about that. And Dana we worked hand in hand. It was not like student and teacher. I learned as much from her, if not more, than I ever taught her. She was our graduate student for 2 years, and then she stayed on for two more as staff. Okay, so she was quite committed. And today she is the development director for an organization headquartered in California, though Yardana lives here in Louisville. It's called Code 2040, which is about bringing more digital technology into Black and people of color communities nationally. Okay, and so here's what Yardana said: I'm always thinking about Ann's invite to live in and create the other America. When I feel uncomfortable, when I consider the risk and inaction, when I consider my time and how I'm spending it, I ask myself, how am I embodying the world we need? The ABI was my first paid employment outside of the restaurant business. It was the first place where I was able to live in my values as the work. It was a place of creativity and passion. We did so much with so little, always moved from relationships. I grew up in my politics. I gained lifelong skills and moved in my life from the foundation of experience and values I learned at the ABI. Since, I've only worked in social justice organizations. So that was a very moving thing for me too. And when your Dana left, then I had an incredible privilege, which was to hire Amber Duke as the program coordinator at the ABI, who came from broadcast journalism and had so many, both people like public presentation, but especially social media communication skills. And Amber was with us first as a volunteer, then she worked part-time on a grant-funded project we had, and then she came on full-time for almost 3 years as the program coordinator. And it was really an honor to work all that time with Amber, and we still do a lot together. And so her comment was this: while I couldn't have planned my current path to ACLU Kentucky Executive Director, Ann's legacy is so much a part of that path. I left a journalism job to dip my toe into work that was adjacent to social justice movements at the ABI. Though I didn't know it at the time, the ABI was a critical bridge as I was transitioning my career trajectory. My educational background is in broadcast journalism, and I'd worked as a news producer for 5.5 years. And she won Louisville's best news show for 3 of those 5.5 years, I'll say. It was New News was what she produced, WLKY. But I was really disappointed and unhappy with corporate owner influence on what ended up on air. I joined the ABI staff because I'd been a supporter and cheerleader for the Institute's much-needed work as a volunteer. In fact, she was the person, if any of you were there that night at the opening lecture with Julian Bond, she was the person walking around with the microphone that took the Q&A. So that was Amber Duke all that time ago. During my nearly 3 years on staff, I was able to see in action how skills and knowledge and communications could be translated creatively to this work. Of course, Anne's life was the perfect example of an activist journalist so richly contributing to broader social movement. It was through the ABI's work that I started developing closer relationships with ACLU Kentucky staff and ultimately left the Institute to become the ACLU Kentucky's first communication director. Jenny Stith was a graduate student in my department, Women's Gender and Sexuality Studies, when Amber and I were running that Healing History Academy through the Kellogg grant, the racial healing grant I mentioned. And I thought of Jenny from, she had been my student as well. I thought of her as having the maturity, and not all graduate students do, unfortunately, to really show up and be very reliable. So she was our student assistant on the Healing History Academy. And today she lives in Colorado and is the executive director of an organization called WINGS. And here she says, in my role as executive director of WINGS, which supports adult survivors of childhood sexual abuse, I've deepened my understanding of racialized trauma and the widespread systems of oppression that have created that violence while also denying it. The seeds of consciousness were most definitely planted for me during my time in ABI, in being involved with the annual Ann Braden Lecture on Mass Incarceration, and in working with the Kellogg Racial Healing Project. I gained a lot being in a group where these issues were discussed openly with the goal of trust building, shared understanding, and shared resilience. I also gained a lot by working on the Ann Braden Lecture Program and driving Michelle Alexander, that's part of the work, folks, to her speaking engagement on the new Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Color Blindness. Taking in these issues while doing my WGS degree added so much depth of understanding to the complexities and callings of our time. And I want to say I have stayed in touch with Jenny periodically, and Jenny has, I have seen her take work against racism as gets translated into the work to support survivors of childhood sexual abuse in a much more profound way over the subsequent years of her leadership at that organization. Alicia West was the other grad student that we had the first year. The second year we had Jenny was Alicia's first year. And Alicia today is a literary agent at Victress Literary in Washington State, which is where she had come here from. And she says, I grew up in a community and family that believed the idea that racism was something in the past and wasn't baked into our systems. It wasn't till I arrived in Louisville and learned about Ann Braden that I started to understand how false and dangerous these beliefs are. Following Ann's legacy and yours, Dr. Fossil, has meant that I think about racial and socioeconomic equity in every area of my life, from the groups I become involved in to the conversations I have with friends. It's meant reading books, taking seminars, visiting important racial justice sites like the George Floyd Square Memorial in Minneapolis, which she had just been to, taking action through protests, and learning how to be an ally without taking over. Mostly, it's been about listening, learning, and making room. But I'm not sure I would have considered any of this as important as I do if I hadn't learned about Ann Braden's life and legacy. And I clipped this because it's so much text on a page. But one other thing she said that I think will really be heartwarming to many of you in this room is she said, honestly, I'm not quoting here, I'm paraphrasing. I have a hard time separating how I feel about Ann Braden and the ABI from how I feel about Louisville, where I learned how many layers of history and of social justice history are embedded in this special place. So I thought that was really cool. Alexis Johnson, PhD, University of Virginia, and that's where she got her PhD, and called the Social Foundations of Education is her PhD. Today, she's a community oral historian and project coordinator back in her native South Carolina of the Lowcountry Oral History Initiative, College of Charleston. I can't take a lot of credit for the person that Alexis became, but I'm really proud of all that she has done. I recall how excited I was to be paired with the ABI for my assistantship because I entered graduate school with the desire to apply what I learned in my Pan-African Studies courses theory with real-world solutions praxis toward the pursuit of racial justice. I had no knowledge of Ann Braden prior to beginning my grad studies and assistantship with the ABI. When I became acquainted with Ann's story, I was quite surprised to learn about a white woman's decision to dedicate her life's work to the cause of racial justice. The ABI is also where I began my journey in the field of public history. I produced an exhibit for the 40th anniversary of the Kentucky Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, for which Angela Davis served as a keynote. My time at the ABI significantly influences my role and work, particularly the ways that academic institutions can support grassroots efforts for racial and social justice. I'm deeply indebted to and grateful for the mentorship of Kate and the ABI for shaping the person and professional I am today. May Ann's spirit continue to guide those of us engaged in the unfinished business of racial justice. Marion Williams succeeded Amber as our program coordinator and served in that role for 3 years, although she had worked with Amber and me. I hired her initially part-time as a replacement while Amber was on maternity leave. And Marion Williams is a freelance writer, a very acclaimed writer, but also today serves as the program manager for the Center of the Preservation of Civil Rights Sites at the University of Pennsylvania and is a resident of Philadelphia. And there's Miriam pictured when she first started working with the ABI. I was living in Scotland for a semester and was away, so she did a lot of the work that a director would do, and she's shown there showing Khalil Muhammad, who was the speaker that year, this was 2014, around West Louisville, some of the sites. I think she's showing him Blaine Hudson's book on two centuries of Black Louisville. Here's what she said, and it was very specific because she had just come back from Montgomery. I thought about the Bradens, the Wades, and the ABI as I toured the EJI's Peace and Justice Museum in Equal Justice Initiatives, Peace and Justice Museum in Montgomery, and the National Memorial for Peace and Justice 5 days later. I skipped the sections in the museum about segregation, the civil rights movement, and mass incarceration because I thought to myself, I feel like we covered all this at the ABI. I don't need a refresher. But I wondered later if Ann Braden or the Wades were pictured featured anywhere there, and they're not, to my knowledge. Near the end of the memorial, which is also known as the National Lynching Memorial, there are bronze sculptures representing the Black Lives Matter movement. Every statue is phenotypically Black. Referring to the statues, I later said to my coworkers, what is that saying to white people? What are they supposed to be doing? Where's the call to action for them? End quote. I'm not sure I would have had those questions if I hadn't known about Ann Braden or known some of the white people she mentioned. So I guess I expect white people to do more. And last, we have Mally Teal Feltner, who today lives in Raleigh, North Carolina, and is a business relationship manager for the National Civil Engineering Company. And Mally says, I would have to say the biggest impact this experience and Ann Braden's legacy plays in my life is the constant reminder that the actions of everyday people can create lasting change when they decide to stand up for what's right, regardless of the legal and social obstacles standing in the way. I'll never forget the projects I had a chance to work on during my time at ABI and the skills I developed through this work, especially the annual lecture events and the incredible speakers I got to meet because of my role. I've also yet to meet another millennial in the past 10 years who knows what microfilm is, let alone someone who has experience doing the kind of public history research we were able to through the resources at the ABI. And finally, I just want to end by looking forward. Okay, so the ABI has just last month gotten a new director who's pictured here some years ago, like during the pandemic, holding an autographed copy of a book collection that we got through a donor who some of you know, Reverend Elwood Sturtevant, had this enormous, really incredible collection of autographed, many of them first edition copies of a lot of very prominent social and racial justice histories. This is from Shirley Chisholm's signature of her autobiography, Unbought and Unbossed. And so Angela Story is a cultural anthropologist who worked with me throughout the 2020 uprisings, the work we did trying to mobilize more white people on the campus, and has been very involved with the ABI over the last 4 years. So she's an associate professor in the Department of Anthropology. I thought that would leave you with looking toward the future. And I think Anne always had that point of view, and that really meant a lot to me. Thank you very much. I was asked to make an announcement, too, by the Ann Braden Institute. The annual Ann Braden lecture had to be rescheduled because of illness of the speaker in November. It's been rescheduled now for April 18th at 6 p.m. in a Bigelow Hall at U of L. It's free and open to the public. I encourage you to bring all ages. It's a young creative writer and scholar by the name of Kiese Lehman, and if you haven't read his work, you certainly should. But the name of the talk is Why America Needs Revision. So I highly encourage you to come out to that talk. Thank you again.
I said I'd like to bring this conversation into the 21st century. The here and now, if I may, Courier Journal article titled U of L March Targets Anti-DEI Legislation. Students, faculty, and staff hold protest against Senate Bill 6. And that was penned by Rachel Smith. As most of you know, that Senate Bill 6 is a bill that's currently in the state legislature, is now going back to the House. And if it passes, it will target programs in universities across the state of Kentucky that focus on DEI, diversity, equity, and inclusion. Those programs, as all of us know, helped African Americans and people of color adjust to college life. So I knew that, but what I did not know about that bill until I read this article is that it probably is going to eliminate the University of Louisville Woodford R. Porter Scholarship, and that is how many people of color get the funding to attend University of Louisville. And so those students are now worried that they may lose their scholarship and not be able to finish their education at the university. I wondered what Kate had to say about that. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Jim. And, you know, I did retire from the University of Louisville, so I'm not really representing them anymore. And I'll say that I had a great career there, but I have not been happy about the way that U of L's communication apparatus and its leadership has not taken a more forceful and more proactive stance on these very, very threatening, damaging bills. The Porter scholarships are at risk, and there are so many other sorts of initiatives that serve students of color and students from other marginalized populations that attacking DEI will really, really meaningfully harm those students. And so I feel that we need to be more and more forcefully outspoken on that. I was very excited. I knew that the rally was happening. A friend of mine on the faculty who had encouraged the students to organize, you know, helped spearhead that rally. So I knew that it was afoot. And I hadn't seen that article. I just hadn't read the paper. And so I'm really glad to see it got that kind of coverage. I think we all need to be taking action against Senate Bill 6? And you can do that, I might add, by calling your legislators using the number 1-800-372-7181. And while I'm at it, I'll just mention one other very, very harmful bill. And there are so many. I mean, really, we definitely have a war on Louisville happening in Frankfort here. But the Safer Kentucky Act, Chris was not at the microphone, but I knew he was on top of this. So let me say that the Safer Kentucky's Act, HB 5, has passed, will get vetoed in the next day or so. And then there will be a legislative attempt to override the veto. So use that same number, 1-800-372-7181, to encourage your representatives to do all they can to crush that attempt to override the veto. But it basically will criminalize unhoused people. The Kentucky Center for Economic Policy has estimated that it could cost the state up to $1 billion for increased incarceration costs.
The views expressed here in terms of asking folks to contact their state legislature are those of our guest and not that of the host or WFMP 106.5 FM radio.
Anybody else?
All right.
Thank you so much.
Kate, thank you so much. It has taken me and I think all of us down memory lane in one sense, as well as stepping forward into the future and looking at the faces of young women and young men who are carrying on this legacy. But I have some important announcements to make. First of all, each one of you at your place has an announcement for the program with the Reverend John Deere on April 11th, and it's meant to be taken home and put on your calendars. He's going to talk about his new book, and you can purchase his new book there as well if you like, called The Gospel of Peace, a commentary on Matthew, Mark, and Luke from the perspective of nonviolence. Put this on your calendar. Make a reservation through your information on the bottom of your sheet and go from there. I want to talk about our next program here, the third Thursday lunch. It's going to be on April the 18th, which is a critical date for the Ann Brayden Institute and its speaker that night. We are most probably going to be Zooming that program because of the schedule of our speaker, who is a Louisvillian and who lives in Louisville. Her name is Farah Mokhtarizadeh, and she is a multicultural person who was born in Louisville from an Irish-American mom and an Iranian dad. She has spent part of her time living in the Middle East, part of her time getting her PhD in Dublin. So she has returned to her roots both from her father and her mother, but in any case, her program is going to be about feminism in Iran, the women in Iran who are struggling for their rights, and men as well, the wars in Ukraine and Gaza and in Sudan and on, but Farah is close to all these issues from personal experience as well as her lifelong involvement from her roots, and so I think it's going to be a really exciting program. I'll bid you all goodbye for now.
Folks, we're out of time. We want to say thanks to our guest today, Dr. Kate Fossil. The Solutions of Owls program that features Kate Fossil will be repeated Tuesday, March 26th at 8 a.m. and Wednesday, March 27th at 6 a.m. You can listen live stream by visiting our website at forwardradio.org and clicking on Listen Live Now. The Solutions of Owls program featuring Kate Fossil will be placed in the WFMP archives. To listen via our archives, visit our website at forwardradio.org, choose Program Archives, and then the Solutions of Owls program that features TTL and Kate Fossil. We want to thank the Louisville Fellowship of Reconciliation and Source of Justice for their support in helping us produce the broadcast that featured Kate Fossil. Our editor is Carolyn Brooks Johnson. For Solutions of Violence, I'm Jim Johnson.